Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, June 28, 2020. I am your reader, Dan Shear. I'll be reading local news from the Waterloo-Cedar Falls and Northeast Iowa area. Our first article, New Laws Effective on July 1st, by Aaron Murphy from the Courier Lee Des Moines Bureau. Starting Wednesday, Iowans will be free to carry guns in courthouses, but not in courtrooms, and they could also face harsher punishments for animal cruelty. Also, lemonade stands are now legal in Iowa. Believe it or not, kid-run lemonade stands were technically illegal in Iowa prior to this year's legislative session. They are now legal thanks to the actions of state lawmakers and Governor Kim Reynolds. The legalization of lemonade stands is one of many new laws that went on the books this year, and a host more go into effect Wednesday, July 1st. Many pieces of legislation still await Reynolds' approval or veto. Because the new coronavirus pandemic forced lawmakers to put the session on hold for nearly 3 months, they did not complete their work until June 14th. Here are some of Iowa's newest state laws and some that just need Reynolds' signature. Law enforcement constraints. The 2020 session of the Iowa legislature likely will most be remembered for significant racial justice legislation approved in the wake of ongoing protests over the death of a Minnesota man who was killed after a police officer knelt on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Drafted, debated, passed by lawmakers, and signed by the governor in just 10 days. House File 2647 bans law enforcement officers from using chokeholds unless an officer feels his or her life is threatened, bars agencies from hiring officers previously fired for misconduct or excess use of force, requires training on de-escalation techniques and anti-bias, and allows the state attorney general to investigate an officer's conduct when his or her actions result in an individual's death. Quote, what makes this historical is we are righting a historical wrong, unquote. Ako Abdul Samad, a black man and state lawmaker from Des Moines, said as legislators discussed the proposal June 11th, I'm saying to you today, my beloved brothers and sisters, and I mean all of you, not only are you a part of history, you are rectifying history. And that is something that you can tell your babies, your grandchildren, so they can tell this story from now on, what we did in Iowa. Absentee ballots. The state's top elections officials will require permission from state legislative leaders before mailing absentee ballot request forms to voters during a public health emergency. Republican Secretary of State Paul Pate, in an effort amid the coronavirus pandemic to limit the number of in-person voters for Iowa's June 2 primary election, mailed absentee ballot request forms to every active registered voter in the state. The result was a record-setting turnout for a primary election. Senate Republicans introduced and approved legislation that would have prohibited the Secretary of State from taking similar action in the future. A compromise in the House led to House File 2486, which allows the Secretary of State to propose such action to the Legislative Council, which is made up of House and Senate leadership. The governor signed the bill Friday. We think that's important, no matter who's Secretary of State, that one person shouldn't have the authority to make such significant elections changes without the legislature's involvement. Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican from Wilton, said after the compromise passed the House. Tobacco 21. Sure, it was already federal law, but state lawmakers also raised the legal age for purchasing tobacco and vaping products to 21. By passing Senate File 2268, state lawmakers ensured Iowa law enforcement officials will be able to enforce the law and that the state would continue to receive up to $3.2 million in federal funding for state-run substance abuse programs. Reynolds has not yet signed this bill into law, but is expected to. Medical cannabis. The state's medical cannabis program was updated, although not everyone agrees it was for the best. Advocates of the program and some state lawmakers wanted a much broader expansion to make the program more feasible for more potential patients. Other lawmakers, Reynolds, and the Reynolds-appointed State Medical Cannabis Advisory Board supported more modest changes, which came in the form of House File 2589. The legislation adds post-traumatic stress disorder and severe intractable autism as diagnoses for which an Iowa patient can obtain medical cannabis. It also caps the amount of product a patient can obtain at 4.5 grams of THC over a 90-day period. Critics contended that is too limiting to make the program effective for many potential patients. Here we are, 5 years after passing our original law, and tonight you're going to make it even worse. Wow. No small task, colleagues, said Senator Joe Bolcom, Democrat from Iowa City, during debate on the legislation. Reynolds has not yet signed that bill into law, but is expected to. Gun restrictions. Iowans will be able to carry a firearm in county courthouses, just not in courtrooms. House File 2502 also requires any local government that restricts weapons in a public building must screen anyone who enters the building for weapons and provide armed security personnel inside the building. While lawmakers who supported the measure said it was necessary to ensure safety and provide clarity across all 99 Iowa counties, a gun safety advocacy group claimed the new law effectively forces local governments to allow people to carry guns in public buildings. Animal cruelty. Animal abuse causing serious injury or death will become a serious misdemeanor, and a second offense will be a Class D felony if Reynolds signs House File 737 into law. Abortion waiting period. Although she is expected to, Reynolds has not yet signed House File 594, which would require a one-day waiting period before a woman could get an abortion. Even if she does, the law would seem destined for Iowa's courts, which have already struck down a 3-day waiting period passed by the legislature and signed by Reynolds. Our next article is headlined, Authorities Sought Suspect Before Slaying Victims Vanished, by Jeff Reinitz of the Courier in Waterloo. Authorities were looking for Mitchell Allen Minks for weeks before his girlfriend and her stepfather disappeared from their Chino Valley, Arizona home in late April. Prosecutors obtained a warrant for Minks' arrest April 1st, although the reasons remained sealed until after the bodies of Alyssa Landry, 28, and David Batten, 45, were found buried in her Subaru in an undeveloped lot on an Evansdale cul-de-sac in May. No one has been arrested for killing Landry and Batten, but Chino Valley police describe Minks as a person of interest in the case, and court records allege Minks' father helped Minks bury the bodies with an excavator. Court records obtained by the Courier show Minks, 25, was starting to run afoul of his supervised release, a probation program that follows federal prison sentences before the slayings. The former Waterloo resident had moved to Arizona in June 2019 after serving time for a firearm charge. After about a month of freedom, Scottsdale, Arizona police found a pill bottle containing marijuana in Mink's vehicle during a traffic stop July 24, 2019, according to court records. It wasn't clear if he was arrested for the infraction, but federal probation officials learned of the encounter. Minks allegedly used marijuana and methamphetamine in August, according to probation records. He then missed drug testing appointments in September, February, and March. Sometime around March 25, 2020, he moved without notifying his probation officer. 2 days later, probation officials asked the court for a warrant, saying his whereabouts were still unknown and he was a risk to the community. Minx was apparently staying with Landry at Batten's home on Chino Drive. Records indicate Minx and Batten didn't get along, a fact that wasn't lost on family members. The last contact anyone had with Batten was the afternoon of April 19, when he texted relatives and talked to his brother on the phone. The following day, family members became concerned because they hadn't heard from him. They went to the house and found the TV on, the cat unfed, and Batten's guns missing. Officers found possible bloodstains on the front porch and another stain, still damp, on the living room carpet. The cushion of a living room chair was soaked in what appeared to be blood, and the amount of blood led investigators to conclude the person who suffered the injury would have needed emergency care, according to court records. Someone had attempted to clean a rug next to the chair. Investigators also found drag marks and tire impressions that pointed to a body being loaded into a vehicle. There was also a spent shell casing at the home. Detectives also found a surveillance video of Minx making purchases at a Chino Valley Circle K convenience store before heading north on Highway 89 in Landry's Subaru. Cell phones belonging to Batten and Landry were traced and found abandoned along the side of a road on Highway 89 near Drake, Arizona, north of Chino Valley. Investigators said it appeared the phones had been tossed out of a moving car. Landry's two dogs were later located in Waterloo, some 1,500 miles from Chino Valley, and neighbors spotted Minx and his father with earth-moving equipment on Timber Oak Road on April 22, court records state. Arizona authorities put out a missing persons notice for Batten, Landry, and Minx, and on April 28, authorities detained Minx at a home at the end of Doris Lane. He was arrested on the federal supervised release violation warrant. The search for Batten and Landry continued in the days that followed. Investigators believed their bodies were in the rugged terrain surrounding Chino Valley and suspected the Subaru was somewhere near Waterloo. That changed on May 27th when local law enforcement, FBI agents, and Chino Valley detectives began searching a small farm at the end of Timber Oak Road and found Landry's Subaru buried with the bodies inside, according to police. Minx's father, Alan Thomas Tucker, was arrested for two counts of abuse of a corpse for allegedly helping Minx bury the bodies. Minx has been returned to Arizona to face a probation violation hearing in federal court, while other charges are pending, according to Chino Valley Police. Our next story changes the tone a bit, with the headline, "We're All, quote, Iowa Nice," unquote. Subheadline, "New Downtown Mural Challenges Many Ideas of What Iowa Looks Like," by Amy Rivers from the Courier, Waterloo. "Iowa is a good place," begins one section of a new University of Northern Iowa website. "And yet, many of us featured here, who are not white or rural, have not experienced Iowa Nice in exactly the same way." Shaib Meacham had few preconceived notions about Iowa when he moved here from the East Coast. Shopping for a refrigerator in Waverly, he chatted with the owner of an appliance store who asked him what he'd be doing now that he lived here. Quote, "I told this lady I was going to be working with kids in Waterloo," Meacham remembered. "It was almost this look of, she felt sorry for me." It seemed strange to Meacham, but other similar interactions kept happening. During a new faculty orientation at University of Northern Iowa, where Meacham is Associate Professor of Literacy Education, officials identified a, quote, "typical UNI student as rural, small town, and white." And a student in his classroom said the only way she could attend the university was by promising her grandmother she would, quote, "stay away from Waterloo." Waterloo and its distinction of being the most racially diverse city in Iowa didn't fit in with others' perception of Iowa, Meacham realized. And because it didn't, the city and its people were ignored, avoided, or outright scorned. "We're operating off of an almost nostalgic interpretation of Iowa, he said. There isn't really anything that shows Iowa is a diverse place. A new wheat-paste mural on the side of the building that houses Jameson's Public House, as well as an accompanying website, shows 52 faces to the contrary. The project, Diversity is Our Strength, is now not only on a building, but online at DIOS, that's D-I-O-S, .uni.edu. On the website, each face is clickable and shows a short bio of each person, as well as their immigration story and what Iowa Nice and Diversity is Our Strength means to them. It's a timely response to the Black Lives Matter protests, but it was inspired before demonstrations erupted this spring, said Nita Fabos, UNI's professor of interactive digital studies. The project is this year's real-world component to Fabos' practicum, a culminating course which brings together students studying web development, imaging, computation, design, writing, advertising, and more to work on a community project. Fabos said she always partners with a fellow UNI employee on that project, and this time teamed with Matt Meacham, who she calls by his nickname, Meach. The project also was based on guidance from Nicole Hannah Jones, the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times writer and Waterloo native who visited UNI last fall. All of my practicum students were immersed. They were reading all of this content, looking at the 24/7 Wall Street report on 2018, which identified Waterloo as the worst place to be black, Fabos said. All that is kind of chilling information, and we wanted to work with Meach to develop a project that is very much a celebration of what we are as a city and the Cedar Valley. The website delves into statistics and a report on the project, then lists additional resources, from articles to videos to podcasts to books for adults and children, as well as films and television series to watch and organizations to follow on social media, all of which students drew upon for their project. I'm just so happy that the website got done despite coronavirus restrictions, Fabos said. My students are amazing. Hats off to them. The pandemic did stop Waterloo West High School and hip-hop literacy students from helping to put up the mural, which was finished last week. Some of those students are themselves featured on the mural. Meacham thinks of the mural as a way to instill pride in a diverse Waterloo, much like a nearby mural on Lafayette Street tells the story of Waterloo's immigrants. He learned the power of such murals by visiting Philadelphia and seeing murals depict musical and artistic legends, which has transformed those neighborhoods. Instead of those areas known for negative attributes, people are taking tours to see those beautiful murals, Meacham said. The physical depiction of those accomplishments has really started to change that sense of identity and pride in being black. And perhaps others can feel a sense of pride in what Iowa looks like today, Fabos said. We have such an incredibly rich collection of ethnicities in our Cedar Valley, Fabos said. My hope is that everybody experiences Iowa Nice, that Iowa Nice can extend beyond our small communities that are homogeneous, and that it can extend to every community, and that people are not fearful of other cultures. Our next headline, Arrest Made in Hit-and-Run Death, by Nancy Newhoff of the Courier, on a story out of West Union. The Fayette County Sheriff's Office on Friday night announced an arrest in a hit-and-run death 2 years ago. Kelly Jo Michael, 26, of Des Moines, was charged Friday with homicide by vehicle, reckless driving, a Class C felony, and leaving the scene of a fatal accident, a Class D felony, according to Sheriff Marty Fisher. Charges stem from an accident June 28, 2018, involving Caden Estling, 14, of Maynard, who was driving a moped along Iowa Highway 150 southbound when he was struck by a vehicle about 2.5 miles south of Fayette. The driver of the vehicle fled the scene. Essling was pronounced dead at the scene after multiple life-saving attempts. Mitchell is being held in the Fayette County Jail on a $50,000 cash-only bond. The Fayette County Sheriff's Office was assisted by the Des Moines Police Department. Cedar Valley Crime Stoppers had a $6,500 reward in the case. Our next headline reads, "Hearing set on $27 million sewer work," by Tim Jamison of the Courier out of Waterloo. The city is planning to borrow up to $27 million to pay for several major sewer projects. Waterloo City Council members are scheduled to hold a public hearing Monday to borrow money through Iowa's revolving loan fund set up for water and sewer infrastructure projects. The loan would be repaid at a 2% interest using sewer fees over a 15 to 20 year period. Chief Financial Officer Michelle Widener said the money will be used for an ongoing reconstruction at the wastewater treatment plant, the Dry Run Creek sewer interceptor currently being built along San Bernan Drive, and to line sewer pipes to prevent water infiltration. Two unrelated sewer projects also are up for consideration this week, including bids for new water and sewer lines to create another industrial park west of the Waterloo Regional Airport. Perk Tobin Construction, Incorporated of Alburnett, appears to be the lowest bidder at roughly $1.9 million to install the infrastructure along Leversey Road to serve the planned Waterloo Air and Rail Park. Council members also will be asked to approve another $292,000 of engineering work for Wayne Klassen Engineering and Surveying, Incorporated of Waterloo on the Northwest Interceptor Sewer. That project involves new pumping stations on North Hackett Road and the National Cattle Congress grounds, along with a new sewer main from NCC to Falls Avenue near Blackhawk Creek. The meeting is scheduled for 5:30 p.m. Monday in the council chambers of City Hall. Some council members will be attending electronically, and residents wishing to comment on items are encouraged to do so via email to the city clerk's office or contact the clerk to get login information to participate in the meeting by phone or Zoom meeting. Other scheduled council business includes a resolution approving 2.5% pay raises for the city's non-bargaining employees. Human Resources Director Lance Dunn said the raises are commensurate to those negotiated with the city's unionized workers and were included in the budget adopted in March. And another resolution raising fees in the commercial street parking ramp downtown. Another article in the sewer, about the sewer, "Fall Sewer Fix May Have Caused Basement Backups," by Tim Jamison of the Courier Waterloo. Work to comply with federal wastewater laws may have contributed to a large number of sewer backups last week north of Burns Park. Waterloo Public Works officials believe work performed last fall to separate sanitary from storm sewer lines at two locations contributed to backups in basements during severe storms Monday. Public Works Division Manager Randy Bennett said the city moved quickly to get Iowa Department of Natural Resources approval to restore one of the cross connections Thursday. "There's no guarantee with the amount of rain that we got that we can say that with 100% certainty that this still might not have happened anyway," Bennett said of the flooded basements. Waterloo was slapped by the U.S. Department of Justice in 2016 with a consent decree requiring it to separate sanitary sewer lines, which run from homes to the treatment plant, from storm sewer lines, which typically discharge without treatment into rivers and streams. Sewer workers televising lines discovered the sanitary and storm sewer lines were connected at the intersections of Lawn Hill Avenue and West 3rd Street and at Home Park Boulevard. The DNR was notified, and those cross connections were removed in September. But problems arose June 9, when the city was hit with 2.1 inches of rain in a few hours, causing a few homes to report basement backups. Per our records, we hadn't had any basement backups in that area since 2010, that were reported anyway, Bennett said. When many homeowners reported backups Monday, it was apparent the former cross connections previously helped prevent the sanitary sewer lines from backing up. Through further evaluation now, it's quite obvious to us through visual observation that this sanitary line was relieving itself into a storm line that went straight north to Blackhawk Creek, and said Brian Bowman, treatment operations supervisor. In retrospect, it served this area for a long time as an overflow device. While the DNR has allowed the city to restore the cross connection at Lawn Hill and Home Park, the city will now be required to report it as an illicit discharge of wastewater into Blackhawk Creek. Engineers have stepped up the search for a permanent solution to the sanitary sewers in that area so the cross connection can be removed permanently. Meanwhile, Bennett noted, homeowners can help the situation by disconnecting home sump pumps and footing drains from sanitary sewers and discharging it on the ground outdoors. A lot of homes in this area were built in the 1920s and 30s, he said. A lot of their footing drains and sump pumps, unfortunately, are tied to the sanitary, which is a huge contributing factor why we have issues with sanitary sewer overflows. City officials noted they have been working to resolve sanitary sewer issues, which have caused overflows and backups in other parts of the community, too. Waterloo has spent $12 million on collection system improvements since 2014 and another $5 million replacing sanitary sewer lines when streets are rebuilt. More than $22 million in collection system and treatment plant projects are under contract or construction now. Some $90 million in projects are reprogrammed over the next 12 years to upgrade city sewer collection and treatment systems. Bennett said he expects to report on the Burns Park area situation and other sewer projects at Monday's City Council meeting. Our next headline reads, Iowa Irish Fest cancels 2020 events, citing COVID pandemic restrictions. This by Amy Rivers of the Courier from Waterloo. Citing the governor's extension of social distancing requirements, Iowa Irish Fest has canceled this year's event. The annual event draws tens of thousands to downtown Waterloo to celebrate Irish heritage. It was scheduled for July 31st through August 2nd. Those who already have purchased tickets will be emailed information on refunds next week, organizers said. Iowa Irish Fest director Chad Shipman said even as late as yesterday, organizers were, quote, hopeful they could hold this year's event, even as other events announced cancellations. Yesterday, Governor Kim Reynolds extended the emergency declaration through July 25th, which calls for social distancing, Shipman said. This declaration end date may possibly be extended again and is too close to our fest start date to allow our committee and our wonderful fans and artists from around the world to properly plan for the festival. Shipman noted travel restrictions still in effect on international travel, which affects the fest's musical acts from Ireland, Scotland, and other countries, was also a determining factor. Unfortunately, government action related to COVID-19 has forced us to cancel our festival, he said. Shipman said organizers are looking forward to planning next year's event for August 6th through the 8th, 2021. This is a reminder. You're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, June 28th, 2020 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. And starting in the Metro Desk column, from Dunkerton, Jeffrey Tix, 1970 to 2020. Jeffrey Eugene Tix, 50, of Dunkerton, died Wednesday, June 24, at Methodist Hospital Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, after a lengthy illness with chronic graft-versus-host disease due to a stem cell transplant. He was born May 7, 1970, in Waterloo, son of Jerome and Marilyn Clomp Tix. Jeff attended Dunkerton, Independence, and Van Eaton school systems. On June 3, 1994, he married Tasha Anderson in Galena, Illinois. Jeff worked at Power Engineering and Mediacom. Survivors include his wife, a daughter, Kelsey Burns, of Bradford, England, two granddaughters, Paige and Dahlia Burns, his mother of Waterloo, and two brothers, Randy Tix of Saco, Maine, and Greg Tix of Waterloo. Preceded in death by an infant daughter, Anna Noelle Tix, a son, Dylan Tix, his father, grandparents, Henry and Virginia Tix, and Woody and Marlis Klomp, father-in-law, Alfred Anderson, and mother-in-law, Sandra Cray Burrett. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Wednesday, July 1st, at Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Waverly. Visitation is 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday at the funeral home. Memorials to the family for a later designation. Online condolences at www.kaisercorson.com. He enjoyed playing guitar, restoring vehicles, which he was in the process with Dylan when he passed away in 2018, woodworking and drawing. From Cedar Falls, Donald Cochran, 1929-2020. Donald Cochran, 90, of Cedar Falls, died Wednesday, June 24, at Pillar of Cedar Valley. He was born December 2, 1929, in Cedar Falls, son of James and Carolyn Ritchie Cochran. He married Catherine Daggett on November 18, 1954, in Cedar Falls. He served in the Iowa Army National Guard, was a machinist and core maker with John Deere, retiring in 1986, and a member of Faith Wesleyan Church in Cedar Falls. Survivors are his wife, two daughters, Carolyn K. Cochran and Pamela Cochran, both of Cedar Falls, a son, Sean Cochran of Cedar Falls, five grandchildren, 13 great-grandchildren, and two great-great-grandchildren, and a brother, Jerry Cochran of California. He was preceded in death by a son, Kimball Cochran, and 10 siblings. Services will be at 11 a.m. Wednesday, July 1, at Richardson Funeral Service, with burial in Cedar Valley Memorial Gardens, both in Cedar Falls. Visitation 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, June 30, at the funeral home, and also for an hour prior to the service. Memorials to the family. Online condolences at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. From Cedar Falls, Melanie Hart, 1949-2020. Melanie Hart, 70, of Cedar Falls, died Wednesday, June 24, at home. She was born August 11, 1949, in Iowa Falls, daughter of Floyd L. and Audrey Helen Hudson Reynolds. She married Daniel D. Hart on August 21, 1982, in Cedar Falls. She graduated from Dubuque Senior High School in 1967 and was Human Resources Manager with TDS Automation for 16 years, retiring in 2015. Survivors include her husband, three children, Becky Ellert of Cedar Falls, Luke Hart of Evansdale, and Daniel Meninga of Janesville, a granddaughter, a brother, Thomas Reynolds of Mystic. Preceded in death by her parents and a son, Adam T. Markham. Memorial services are at 11 a.m. Tuesday, July 7, at Richardson Funeral Service, with visitation from 10 a.m. till service time. Memorials to River Hills School. Condolences may be left at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. From Cedar Falls, Judy K. Stadler, 1949 to 2020. Judy K. Stadler, 70, of Cedar Falls, died June 15th at New Aldea Lifescapes in Cedar Falls. She was born October 18, 1949, in Cedar Falls, daughter of Wilbur and Eldave Penny Myers Rewerts. Survivors include an uncle, Richard Geese of Hamilton, Montana, and a nephew, Carl Beaupre of Wisconsin. Preceded in death by her father, her mother, Eldave Penny Schnock, her stepfather, Carl Schnock, and a sister, Nancy Clue Beaupre. Services, a celebration of life, will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, July 4th, at Crossroads Community Church of the Nazarene, 3622 Hammond Avenue, Waterloo. Richardson Funeral Service assisted the family. Memorials, in lieu of flowers, memorials to the church. Online condolences at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. Judy was a devoted member of Crossroads Community Church of the Nazarene in Waterloo and loved telling everyone about God's love and faithfulness. From Hudson, Bradley W. Ingemels, 1949 to 2020. Bradley Wayne Ingemels, 71, of Clearwater, Florida, formerly of Hudson, died June 15 at Morton Plant Hospital in Florida. He was born May 16, 1949, in Waterloo, son of Robert and Gladys Klein Ingemels. Brad graduated from Hudson High School in 1967. He was employed by Florida Light and Power and retired after 25 years of employment. After moving to Hudson, Brad was employed by the City of Hudson for 12 years. He served on the Hudson City Council, as well as holding various seats on other committees for the city. Survivors include three daughters, Laura Cousins of Sedona, Arizona, Amy Rank of Cape Coral, Florida, and Sarah Scharnhorst of Cedar Falls. Two brothers, Randy Ingemels of Hudson and Grant Ingemels of Clearwater. Special friend Don Meter of Clearwater, four grandchildren, three nephews, and many great nieces and nephews. He's preceded in death by his parents and a brother, Greg. A celebration of life will be 3 to 6 p.m. Friday, July 3rd, at the Hudson Community Center, with sharing at 5 p.m. Keep social distance and masks are encouraged. A family graveside service will be held in Hudson Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials to Randy Ingemels, 104 Pheasant Lane, Hudson, Iowa, 50643. Online condolences at www.lockfuneralhome.com. Brad enjoyed golf, was a long-suffering Tampa Bay Buccaneers fan, and enjoyed NASCAR and socializing. He liked to be busy and would help everybody out. He was friendly and charismatic, had a winning smile, an easy laugh, and made friends everywhere he went. He will be missed by many. From Dewar, Vera Mixdorf Evans, 1928 to 2020. Vera Mixdorf Evans, 91, of Dewar, died at Cobblestone Court in Sumner on June 20th. She was born on November 11, 1928, in St. Paul, Iowa, daughter of Joe and Louise Moorfield Menke. She graduated in 1946 from St. Mary's High School in West Point, Iowa. Vera then graduated from Thompson School of Cosmetology in Des Moines. Later, she completed a dental hygienist program. Vera married Reuben F. Mixdorf on February 26, 1954. He died June 6, 1992. She married Floyd I. Evans on March 10, 1995. He died September 23, 2000. She retired from the Blackhawk County Health Department in 1992. She was a supervisor for the Homemakers Home Health Aides. Survivors include a daughter, Carrie Arthur of Waverly, two sons, Craig Mixdorf of Wichita, Kansas, and Doug McDorf of Prairie du Sac, Wisconsin. Stepsons Jason Evans of Eufaula, Oklahoma, and Stan Evans of San Diego, California. Stepdaughters Janet Kinder of Denver, Colorado, Lori Johnson of Dallas, Texas, 9 grandchildren, 6 great-grandchildren, and a brother and 4 sisters. Preceded in death by her husbands and 8 siblings. Private graveside services were held at Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery. The service was recorded and can be viewed on the funeral home's website. Locke Funeral Home, Waterloo, is assisting the family. Memorials to the family for a fund to be established. Cards sent to the funeral home will be forwarded to the family. Online condolences at www.lockfuneralhome.com. From Waterloo, Laura M. Lobeck, 1932-2020. Laura May Lobeck, 88, of Waterloo, died Saturday, June 27, at Rosewood Estates in Waterloo. She was born April 7, 1932, in Sumner, daughter of Herman and Clara Stallhut Boer. She graduated in 1950 from Sumner High School. On August 28, 1955, she married Henry Bud Lobeck at St. John Lutheran Church in Sumner. Laura worked at Rath Packing Company in the office from 1950 to 1986. She then worked at Black Hawk Plastics from 1987 until retiring in 1997 as office manager. Survivors include a sister-in-law, Eldora Seegers of Marion, and many nieces and nephews. She is preceded in death by her parents, a sister, Marie Boer, a brother, Erwin Boer, brothers-in-law, Edward, Hugo, Carl, and Wilbert Lobeck, and her sisters-in-law, Valeska Boer, Emma Ladich, and Marlis Boer. Services are at 11 a.m. Tuesday, June 30, at Kaiser Korsen Funeral Home in Denver. Visitation will be 10 a.m. until services Tuesday at the funeral home. Burial in St. John Lutheran Cemetery in Sumner. Memorials in lieu of flowers, memorials to Cedar Valley Hospice. Online condolences at www.kaisercorson.com. Together, Henry and Laura grew vegetables and flowers for the Cedar Falls Farmers Market. They also enjoyed going to area casinos. From Waterloo, Sandra K. Sandy K. Adams, 1955-2020. Sandra Sandy K. Adams, 65, of Waterloo, died Wednesday, June 24, at Unity Point Health, Allen Hospital. She was born February 27, 1955, in Waterloo, daughter of C.D. Mike and Leona Kritz Adams. Sandy graduated from Columbus High School and was employed at the Western Home and Bickford Cottage, both in Cedar Falls, prior to becoming disabled. Services will be at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, July 1, at Queen of Peace Catholic Church, with burial in Mount Olivet Cemetery. Visitation is 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday at Haggerty Wyckoff Grarup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway, and for an hour before services at the church. If attending either the visitation or the Mass, masks are mandatory. Memorials to the American Heart Association or Diabetes Association. Online condolences at www.haggertywyckoffgrarup.com. Sandy loved crocheting and was an avid Kansas City Chiefs fan. She enjoyed spoiling her nieces and nephews and great-nieces and nephews with little trinkets. She loved FaceTiming and spending actual time with her family. From Cedar Falls, Theodore Bear Nelson, 1942-2020. Theodore Bear Nelson, 77, of Cedar Falls, died Thursday, June 25, at Unity Point Health, Allen Hospital in Waterloo. He was born August 28, 1942, in Cedar Falls, son of Albert and Ruth Colson Nelson, Jr. Ted married Donna Dunkelberg on July 2, 2005, at the Little Brown Church in Nashua. He worked at John Deere for many years, retiring in March 2001, but continued farming the rest of his life. He was a member of Cedar Falls AmVets Post 49 and was past president of the Fraternal Order of Eagles, number 764, in Waterloo. Private services for Bear Nelson will take place at Dahl Van Hove Shoe Funeral Home. Visitation will be 4 to 6 p.m. Monday, June 29, at Dahl Van Hove Shoe Funeral Home, and a public graveside service will be noon Tuesday, June 30, at Gardner Memory Cemetery in Waterloo. Those attending are required to bring and wear a mask to social distance. Memorials to the hospice of your choice. Online condolences at www.dahlfuneralhome.com. From Elk Run Heights, Jeanette L. Kemmerer, 1927-2020. Jeanette L. Kemmerer, 92, of Elk Run Heights, died Tuesday, June 23, at home. She was born September 6, 1927, in Boone County, daughter of Thomas William and Hazel E. Germer Parks. Jeanette married Robert Wayne Kemmerer on October 10, 1947, in Omaha, Nebraska. He died November 22, 2016. She worked in the munitions plant in Ankeny for several years and then was a homemaker. Jeanette was a member of Linden Methodist Church in Waterloo and was involved in the Circle. Family graveside services were held at Gardner Memory Cemetery, with burial in Gardner Memory Cemetery, Waterloo. Kern's Funeral Service, Kimball Chapel, Waterloo, assisted the families. Memorials to the family. All cards sent to the funeral home will be forwarded to the family. Online condolences at www.kernsfuneralservice.com. From Waterloo, Glenn A. Patterson, 1943-2020. Glenn A. Patterson, 77, of Waterloo, died Thursday, June 25, at Unity Point Health, Allen Hospital. He was born June 22, 1943, in Tipton, son of Elmer and Luva Jean Beaver Patterson. He married Deborah Walker, May 1, 1965, in Waterloo. Glenn was a self-employed carpenter and owned and operated Kitchens Plus in Waterloo for 25 years, retiring in 2018. Services. Due to the COVID-19, a private family memorial mass will be held at St. Edward Catholic Church. A public gathering will be held at a later date. Haggerty Wyckoff Grarup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway is assisting the family. Online condolences at www.haggertywyckoffgrarup.com. From Denver, Irene M. Hilson, 1922-2020. Irene M. Hilson, 97, of Denver, formerly of Waterloo, died Thursday, June 25, at home. She was born November 15, 1922, in Iowa, daughter of Albert K. and Hilda A. Kluster Johnson. She married Robert G. Bob Todd Hilson on June 1, 1946, in Blue Earth, Minnesota. He died February 21, 2009. She worked as a family assistant for many families at nursing homes and private homes. Services for Irene M. Hilson will be at 1 p.m. Friday, July 3rd, at Kern's Funeral Service, Kimball Chapel, with burial in the Garden of Memory Cemetery, both in Waterloo. Visitation is 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, and also an hour before the service at the funeral home. The family asks that masks be worn. The service will be recorded and posted to the funeral home website. Memorials to the family. Irene enjoyed visiting with family and friends, caregiving, reading in both flower and vegetable gardens. Kern's Funeral Service, Kimball Chapel, is in charge of arrangements. Online condolences may be left at www.kernsfuneralservice.com. As a young woman, Irene felt the conviction to follow the teachings of Jesus and became part of a worldwide fellowship of believers. She remained true to that choice the rest of her life. From Jessup, Robert Bob Cresser, 1946-2020. Robert Lawrence Bob Cresser, 73 of Jessup, died Friday, June 26th at home. He was born November 2, 1946 in Waterloo, son of Francis Edward Cresser and Irma Catherine Schmidt Cresser. He graduated from Don Bosco High School in Gilbertville in 1964. He served in the U.S. Navy from 1966 to 1970. On November 21, 1970, he married Jacqueline Rita Youngblood at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Raymond. Bob was a welder and worked at John Deere in Waterloo until retirement. He was a member of St. Athanasius Catholic Church, Knights of Columbus Council 8227, Pump Shear American Legion Post 342, all in Jessup, and United Auto Workers Local 838 in Waterloo. Family services will be held Thursday, July 2, at St. Athanasius Catholic Church, Jessup, with a public graveside service at 11:30 a.m. Thursday at St. Athanasius Catholic Cemetery. Military rites will be conducted by Pump Shear American Legion Post 342 of Jessup. The Mass will be live-streamed on the church website, www.saintaparish.com. Visitation is 1 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, July 1st, at White Funeral Home in Jessup, with the Knights of Columbus Rosary, and 2 p.m. masks and social distancing will be required. Memorials to St. Athanasius School in Jessup and to Unity Point Hospice in Waterloo. And now we have some service notices here. From Decorah, Renee V. Calderon. Renee Vera Calderon, 57, of Decorah, died Thursday, June 25, at Winneshiek Medical Center in Decorah of natural causes. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Thursday, July 2, at Emmanuel United Church of Christ in Clarksville. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Wednesday at Redmond Schwartz Funeral Home in Clarksville, and for an hour before services at the church. Memorials may be directed to the family, www.redmond-schwartz.com. From Independence, William Bill Payton. William H. Bill Payton, 76, of Independence, died Thursday, June 25, at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital in Waterloo. Visitation will be 1 to 4 p.m. today, June 28th, at White Funeral Home in Independence. Social distancing and face masks are encouraged. A military service will begin at 4 p.m. Private family funeral services will be held Monday, burial in Wilson Cemetery in Independence. Online condolences at www.white-mounthope.com. From Cedar Falls, Daniel M. Haggerty. Daniel Maurice Haggerty, 67, of Cedar Falls, died May 11 at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, Iowa City, from cancer. Memorial service is 10:30 a.m. Thursday, July 2, at St. Patrick Catholic Church, with an interment in Greenwood Cemetery. Full military rites will be conducted at the grave by Cedar Falls AMVETS Post 49. Visitation will be an hour prior to services Thursday at the church. Memorials to the family. From Janesville, Mary A. Cornelius. Mary Ann Cornelius, 80, of Janesville, died May 4 at home. Family-directed memorial services will be at 11 a.m. Friday, July 3rd, at Antique Acres, with interment in Hillside Cemetery, both in Cedar Falls. Memorials may be directed to the family. Richardson Funeral Service is assisting the family. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, June 28, 2020. I'm your reader, Dan Shear. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening today.